Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello, listeners. Tim Sylvie here. Before we introduce today's guest, I need to head through the airwaves to bring in a man who casts F1 opinions through his burgeoning YouTube channel, which is a mere 4,000 subs short of 300,000 strong. So get over there, people. Search for Tomo on YouTube. Give the man a sub and get him to that big milestone. Tom McCluskey, how are you? It's been a while. How are things?
It has. I'm good. Yeah, I feel like I've been close to 300,000 for so long now. It's really like a sub growth has just kind of petered out, but the views are still there. People still listen to my opinion and think I'm somewhat relevant. And that's obviously as the, you have to be a bit of a narcissist to put videos of yourself in the internet, right, Tim?
Yeah, absolutely. You 100% do. It is difficult though, isn't it? It's hard to keep that movement, that forward trajectory going.
It is. It's not an easy game, but I love what I do. And it's a pleasure to be here once again talking with you, Tim, and talking with today's guest as well.
Well, talking of which, shall I introduce him?
Yeah, come on then, let's see who it is.
So today we're joined by Blake Hinsey, or Break F1, as you may know him. After growing up in Dallas in the US, a chance meeting with a Mazda MX-5 sparked a love affair with motorsport that began behind the wheel before studying mechanical engineering at the University of Texas at Arlington. Following his graduation and working on the brilliant Formula Student Program, he eventually found himself through hard work and determination working at the then Sahara Force India team in Formula One. From there, he went from strength to strength, ending up working with the likes of Max Verstappen in 2016 and 2017. We join him today, however, reinvented as a content creator in Formula One, using his knowledge of the sport to feed his growing audience. It's a pleasure to have him here to chat about his life, career, thoughts and opinions. Blake, welcome to the Motormouth podcast.
Tim, good morning. Tomo, good to see you again twice in 1 week. It's a treat, man. We need to get up to, those are rookie numbers. We need to bump those up. Oh, but that was a really, really good intro. And people asked me to introduce myself and what I've done. I could not get anywhere close to what Tim has just done. That was really good, man.
And I wrote it myself because usually I just get ChatGPT to do it.
I was about to say, don't give him credit until he's confirmed it, Tim. I want to see the logs, Tim.
This was me. This was me.
I had a look the other day, not because I'm a narcissist, because I wanted to know what does ChatGPT know about me, if anything, and how nonsense is it? It doesn't know anything about me, which is great. So I'm happy.
Maybe Blake, today's podcast will feed ChatGPT all the information it needs. So let's start with where are you joining us from today? Because something tells me you've got a bit of a streamer man background to you in terms of the setup.
I've got the Texas flag. That's just to remind me where I grew up. But I'm just outside of Milton Keynes, so not too far from my old working place, middle of nowhere. It's nice and quiet, and if I need to come to London or something, it's not too far from the train station.
I always find it funny when someone from Dallas ends up in somewhere like Milton Keynes. I mean, I'm nothing against Milton Keynes. I live near Milton Keynes, so I've got no problem with it. But you know, it's not the most glamorous destination in the world, is it? Is it weird? Do you miss the States?
I do a little bit, but I'll tell you what though, Milton Keynes is probably one of the cities in the UK that I've been to that reminds me the most of a city at home. Like you've got like you know, there's okay, they added roundabouts. Those are intimidating if you're not from around these parts.
Intimidating.
But you know, everything's a grid system. You've got all the big shops that you need to go to. So it's convenient in that regard. And that reminds me of, you know, being in the US, especially in Dallas. But yeah, it's all right. You know what? I've been here for 12 years now. I enjoy it. I enjoy it. The weather is average at best. At best, yeah. And then, but when, you know what, when there's a great day like this weekend, there's a couple awesome ones. I had the barbecue going all weekend and I was just happy. I was just enjoying it. So, you know, you got to be down in the mud a little bit to enjoy the nice days.
Yeah, we do and occasionally get a bit, weather that is a little bit Texan, maybe somewhat. But I mean, when you first came to the UK, were you in Milton Keynes from the start? Because was it Oxford Brookes you went to uni?
Yeah. I probably spent my first 6-7 years around Oxford because that was an easy commute to Force India, for example. And then when I was traveling still at Red Bull as a performance engineer, you know, the commute to Red Bull from Oxford kind of sucked. But I was only in the office like half the year. The rest of the time I was on an airplane or at a racetrack or something. So that wasn't too bad. But yeah, I'm very fond of Oxford. It's just a bit too expensive for me.
Yeah, it's very expensive. It's a
content creator.
It's a lovely city, though. Really, really nice. Well, let's dive into the Formula One then. You were involved with Formula Student, then went on to work at Force India when it was Sahara Force India, right? As a performance engineer. Do you remember your very first day? Because I'd imagine moving country, coming to a new place, starting at a Formula One team. Even Force India, where it's, you know, still sizable, it's a proper operation. Did it feel intimidating walking through the doors that first day?
A little bit, yeah. And my first day was super interesting. So they had, I can't remember the chassis code, but it was the previous year's Force India chassis, is a VJM something, on the 7-post rig. And if you're not familiar with what the 7-post rig is, it is basically they strap the car down to these platforms. And you basically actuate the suspension and simulate suspension loads and aerodynamic loads, trying to optimize the springs and dampers so you can get better platform control or better mechanical grip out of the car. My first week, I think I spent 4 days in a row in the 7-post rig. And at first you're like, oh my God, it's a real Formula One car in a 7-post rig. 3 days later, you're like, please, if I never see another 7-post rig in my life, I will be completely happy. It's a cold room. It was in the middle of December. And you just hear that, you know, this thing going through these sweep cycles to simulate the motion of the road. And it's just hydraulic sounds. And then it's cold and you wait 2 minutes for a run to finish. Then you look at the data, you change something else and repeat that for 4 days. That's a really good way to make sure nobody else ever wants to work in vehicle dynamics ever again.
Well, I guess that kind of experience somewhat, because there's so much glamour attached to F1 from the show point of view, right? And there's obviously certain expectations, but when you go into it, it's going to be, I almost went down that route myself. I was doing motorsport engineering at college and then I got accepted to Coventry. And I could have done something similar to Formula Student. I didn't go down that route in the end, but like, what were your expectations going into your course at Oxford Brookes? Did you know, like, I want to be a performance engineer, or were you just like, I just know I want to work in F1 and I'm not really sure where, but I'm just going to give this a go.
I had to think, and it's a really typical thing because, you know, race engineer is a very visible thing to everybody on the outside. You know, most people on the outside don't know what a controls engineer is. They don't know what a systems engineer is. They're not sure what an aero performance engineer does versus an aero engineer. But I was like, I think I want to be a race engineer. I like being at the racetrack. I had a little bit of experience at a club level, which is completely amateur, but it's like that environment was exciting and exhilarating. So I was like, okay, I want to be a race engineer. So I saw a lot of people getting jobs in the industry. But at that point, when I was going to Oxford Brookes, I was like, I will take any job. I will literally take any job to get my foot in the door because I've moved, you know, across the world, spent a lot of money in accommodation and tuition fees to do a year, to make connections, to meet people. I want to get into Formula One and I'll take anything to get in the door. Fortunately, there was a placement vehicle dynamics student job going, and the salary was staggeringly impressive. It was basically what they would pay, you know, a second year, a third year on their placement year, which was like peanuts. It was bad. I'm not even going to say it out loud. But I was like, you know, I'm 26. This is my first full-time job out of bachelor's degree and a motorsport master's degree. And I'm making peanuts. I was like, I'll take it. I'll do it. I had to borrow money to keep going that year. But it was like the foot in the door. I'm working in vehicle dynamics. Very shortly thereafter, they're like, okay, you're not terrible. We'll give you a reasonable salary, which was still crap.
But from 2011 to 2014, was that the period where you were trackside performance engineer?
So I basically went into the team. I was there for 8 months. And then you remember Bahrain 2012? There was the civil protest kicked off, and they're like, we're not going to race. Some of the personnel left the track. They went home. They're like, this is not cool. This is not safe. They left. And then despite being, you know, persuaded by the teams, like, you know what, if you're not feeling safe, you know, you can go home. This is when Force India skipped free practice too, so they could get back to the hotel under daylight. Right. So some people left. They were not allowed to come back, is my understanding. And the next week was Mugello test. And after that was Barcelona 2012. They're like, hey, two weeks before that, I asked the chief engineer. I was like, you know, I'm vehicle dynamics engineer. I've been there for a while, but I'm hungry. I was like, I want to be a trackside performance engineer. You know, like, that's the step to be in a race engineer. What do I need to do? And he's like, you know what? You're just going to have to wait. You know, you're going to have to serve your time. You're in a good spot. You're working in the simulator with the vehicle dynamics group. That's good, but you just need time. Well, after Bahrain, they're like, hey, how about going to the track? I was like, all right, fine. Then I was thrust into the deep end. I was 8 years into Formula One. I had no formal, you know, motorsport trackside training. I didn't know, you know, like I didn't cut my teeth in Formula Four. I didn't cut my teeth doing any GT cars. It was a baptism by fire, and realistically, it was sink or swim for the first year and a half, easy.
And so presumably at that point, you go trackside, you're now dealing with the race drivers. So you've got the likes of Paul de Rester and Sergio Perez, people like that. How did you adapt to that? Was it intimidating? Did you feel overawed by it with that sort of first time where you've got to talk at a level to a Formula One racing driver? How did it sit with you?
Well, that's working in the simulator was good because you got experience talking to the drivers, asking them for feedback on stuff. But, you know, when you're on the intercom in the garage talking to the driver between sessions, you know, in between runs about the car balance and stuff like that, at first, you know, I was working at that time, I was working with Jean-Pierre Lambiezza. He was also the race engineer there. So I worked with GP my entire trackside career, 6 years. So 3 years at Force India and 3 years at Red Bull. But talking to the drivers at first was pretty intimidating until you realize it's like they're just other people on the team, you know? And it's like, but more of it was the pressure on me to not say anything stupid, because to be completely honest with you, I didn't know what I was doing at the time.
Well,
you know, realistically, I didn't know what I was doing. And I was leaning very heavily on the performance engineer on the other car. I was leaning very heavily on GP to basically, okay, what's the bare minimum of stuff I need to do to make sure I don't cause an issue, and then how do I add performance to what's going on?
So many of these sort of high profile, high pressure jobs, I always find a lot of people don't know what they're doing, and it is proper sink or swim. And you either capitulate under the pressure, or you embrace it and you learn and you get there. But there are so many people I run into on a daily basis who I think you're in a really senior position, and I don't know how you've got there. You don't know what you're doing.
And that was one of those things. It was like, you know, it's a high pressure job, performance engineer. You know, some of the main things you're looking after the brakes, which are a huge safety item. You're the point of contact for brakes on the track. Brake balance, at the time it was KERS recovery, so making sure you had enough energy harvest for race and qualifying, and managing that and feeding that back to the driver. Differential settings, and also fueling the car for both qualifying and the race. Those are the kind of things, if you screw up qualifying or race fuel, you're disqualified or you do not finish the race. So, you know, those were some pretty high pressure things. And in my first race event, I had a huge sketch with qualifying fuel in Barcelona 2012, to the point where, you know, GP, being cool head and having been a performance engineer for many years in the past, he was, you know, he got me, he's like, you know, you know, we'll end up with a couple laps too much fuel, but just add in, you know, whatever, 3 laps of fuel and we'll be good for the next run. And I was just like, you know, that was huge pressure. And that's, oh my God. And there's the other situations, like you're monitoring the race fuel. And let's say that, you know, you didn't realize that something happened with your fuel spreadsheet and you actually have a lap too little fuel. that feeling at lap, let's say 20 out of 50, literally your heart sinks.
Yeah.
Your pulse goes through the roof. And I'm talking about like physically your heart rate, you know, it's just this response. It's super high pressure, because if you screw that up, you've let a team of hundreds of people down. And, you know, especially if you're on for a result.
You look at Verstappen last year in the Red Bull at Singapore. I mean, what kind of insight can you give? Obviously, you weren't there, but that is essentially, there was one lap, not enough fuel, right? So Max couldn't complete the lap. And then he ended up qualifying down the order, and it ended up not being a great race for him. So what insight can you give on that?
And that was even worse, because that was what broke his win streak as well. So, you know, the championship had been locked up, but that was one of these milestones that you only maybe get one shot in your career to do that potentially. So that's, you know, for him, you could tell the level of frustration, because he knew exactly what it was. Singapore not on pole. It's going to be a tough race, man. So Singapore last year was a really interesting thing. And the team did confirm this, but I was watching the race and I was like, I knew exactly what happened. So there's two things that happen in qualifying and changeable conditions. The number of laps you can do depends on the track condition. So, you know, if the grip's high, you could get 8 laps in the session. If the grip's low, you can get 7 or maybe even 6. So that's one thing. Then there's another aspect of that is the fuel consumption in the wet condition. If the grip is low, you don't need much fuel per lap. If the grip is high, you need a lot of fuel per lap. So you have this thing of trying to guess how much grip we can have in the session, you know, and that tells you both how many laps and how much fuel you can put in. But if you miscalculate one of those slightly, even if you think you've added margin, you can still end up underfueled by a lap, which is what happened.
So hang on. So if it's a wet track, you don't need as much fuel.
Yep.
Why?
The amount of time that you spend full throttle is lower. It seems like it's like, how does that work? But realistically, the fuel flow rate is restricted to 100 kilos per hour. And most of the time, your fuel consumption is determined by the time that you spend full throttle. You know, the part throttle time is, you know, much, much lower consumption. So you had that. You had the perfect storm of, is it 7 or 8 laps? Because in the intermediate conditions, you fuel for the session. You don't say, we're going to do one timed. You put as much fuel as you can get in to make sure that you're on the track through the whole session, because you saw that very last lap was the fastest lap possible. And it was way up before you had to box. It's wild. But it's a really, like, as a performance engineer, or maybe the engineers are doing fuel at Red Bull now, it's a super fun game. It's like literally F1 manager, and you're on speed and you're plugged into the adrenaline machine. You're talking to the race engineer, you're talking to strategy. What do you think the lap time is going to be? How much fuel consumption are we going to make? And you're like, the car's coming down the pit, like say a normal qualifying session, the car's coming down the pit lane after Q3 run one. You're looking at how much fuel is in the tank as it's entering the pit lane. You're burning off, you know, 10 grams, 10 grams, 10 grams. You're like, right, add 7 kilos. No, wait, let's do 6.8. so that we only have like 300 grams of margin or 200 grams of margin.
It's mental. This must break some people. Like that scenario you just talked through there, coming down the pit lane, car's coming towards you, you can hear it, you can see it coming, you can see the fuel going down, you've got to think quickly, you've got to act fast. There must be times where people have just completely lost their shit and just got, I don't know, I've gone blank. Someone else is going to have to deal with this.
But that was me in Spain in my first race. So, you know, you've got this, I'm not supposed to be here, you know. I'm really under the pressure, and then you've got to make those decisions. And you know, that's the thing where it's like, it all is also a team. And like when you have a well-seasoned race engineer, they know what's going on. It's like, right, well, we're going to be slightly suboptimal, but we're going to finish this qualifying session and don't worry about it. It's wild, man. It's wild. Nice. But like imagine you're playing F1 manager and you've got the adrenaline plugged into you and it's pumped up to 11, man. But that is race and performance engineering and strategy and all those people that have to make those decisions, because everybody's looking at you. And if you're a performance engineer, nobody's looking at you. But if you screw up, everybody's looking at you.
It's the kind of job, isn't it, that when you get your job done right, it's just expected and there's not a big for all. Whereas if you get it wrong, then it's like, again, Singapore last year, there's all eyes on that. That's a memorable incident, right? So you don't necessarily get the, like, did you have to, within the team, did you need kind of a pat on the back internally to be like, you've done a good job, because you're not going to get that from the outside world? You know what I mean?
Nah. I mean, you had, I think it was one of those things, you get used to it. It is a really a thankless job sometimes, but at the same time, when your driver has a really good qualifying session, you're making changes to the car throughout the session, you know, in qualifying, dialing in the tools to make sure the brake balance of the differential or rider, they've got an issue at turn three. And it's like, we need to do this. It's like, right, here's a suggestion. What about this? Or you help them find something. It's like, you know that you've done something useful. And if not, if you only have one of those moments, you know that you did a good job. And if the driver got the most out of it, you're happy, you know, and it's a difficult one, but at most of the time, like, race engineering, performance engineering is usually pretty thankless.
Yeah,
it can be. And if you get a great result, you know, everybody's happy and you share in that collectively. But it's one
it
of the things
terrifying. Like it's making fun. Me feel panicky just talking through it.
Your hands
like
sweaty right now?
Yeah, I would be useless. Like I just sit there and go blank. Like I can't do. It's like I'm rubbish at maths. So if someone starts talking to me about maths, my brain just switches off. I go blank. That's what would happen to me. I'd go completely blank. I'd just stop talking and people would just have to pick me up and remove me from the situation. It'd just be a disaster. Yeah. So let's move on to drivers. You've been very lucky. I mean, Red Bull, you've worked with some terrific drivers. So like we said earlier, you worked with Sergio Perez. You've also worked with Max Verstappen. What attributes did you see in Perez? I mean, at the moment, he's competing on a fairly level playing field with Max at the moment. He's doing really well, but over the course of the season, I think many believe he'll probably drop off at some point. Do you think his talent is, though, overlooked sometimes? How highly do you rate Sergio versus someone like Max Verstappen?
I think, let's put it in perspective, though, because like Sergio is an excellent driver by every account. You know,
several podiums for India.
Very, very good on the tires. You know, it's like that conundrum. Go fast, save tires. He does that very well. He's got a very good sense for traction and how to use the tires and how to manage them and save them. When we started, when I started working with him, he came off of McLaren, and I didn't think he was a super, super technical driver, or maybe at the time McLaren, you know, weren't helping him understand all the systems they were using on the car, but it was very clear that he was good at driving the car and explaining what was going on. And he was one of those guys, if the car's in the window, he'll excel every single time. But then you get somebody like Max, who's literally 100% from FP1. There's no build up. It's literally out. I was looking at something during the broadcast last week. Crofty was talking about, you know, how late do they, you know, I'd love to see how they break, because in Miami, the track condition was gripping up. Well, and I think this is probably not super specific to Max, but it goes to show you the level they're on. His first run does a cider, you know, just cruises around the lap, out lap, does a cider lap, checks the grip, everything, breaks. The next lap, breaks 20 meters later, makes the corner. The next lap breaks 20 meters later again. And then the next run, he brings it back by like 5 meters. And you're considering they're going, top speed is about 80 meters in a single second. So you put that in perspective of how precise, and that's a representation of all the guys, but Max specifically goes out very aggressive, very early. And the thing that set him apart from a lot of his teammates, especially recent teammates in the past, is the amount of instability that he can cope with on the car. I think you talked with Alex about that.
Yeah.
Albon. And I worked in the simulator a lot with Albon because I was back in the factory at that point as a simulator performance engineer, but looking at longer term development. And that was one of the things. It's like, we spent a lot of time looking for what are the tools that don't take performance off of the car that add stability to the car in the places where you need it. Whereas like the late entry, where you have to trust that you're leaning into the steering, you're turning in, and you have to expect that car is going to stick. And if there's a control loop in your head saying, this is bad, you can't trust that car and you can't confidently attack that car every lap. Whereas that's something that Max does that set him apart. But so far this season, Checo has been there. Like some Fridays and Saturdays, not quite. But for the most part, Checo's off to a super, super strong season. And that's not an easy task.
So how does Max's approach change? Does that change your job at all? So say, for example, on you're given, right, in one timeline, Blake, your performance engineer to Sergio Perez. Another time, Lum, your performance engineer to Max Verstappen. How do you do your job differently to account for each driver's? Because it sounds like they are, as much as they're both very, very talented, they're also quite different in their approaches.
Yeah. I think from a performance engineering point of view, it's literally this loop, you know, this feedback loop of, for example, let's talk specifically from a performance engineer point of view. Like, we're working with the driver on the differential and the brake balance and the engine braking, which is basically the only tools, A, they have that they can adjust in the car, on a lap, or during the race. Everything else is locked, park from it. You can't change the springs or bars or the setup. You can change the front wing angle, which you can only do between runs, or you've got the brake balance. And I'm working on a video about, you know, why the brake balance is so exciting and how it makes Formula One drivers insane at braking, able to get so much out of the car, is the level of optimization that you can make. And some drivers on a qualifying lap might make two changes. You know, let's think of Barcelona. You've got turn one. Maybe your front tires aren't quite in the window. So you need a little bit more deceleration off of the rear axle. A, because the front tires aren't ready. B, that helps rotate the car when you're using the rear axle more to brake. So, right, you've got turn one.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Go all the way around the lap. Maybe turn five's a little bit tricky as it's downhill, a little bit off camber. And then you go through down to turn 10. So you've gone through the fast right-hander, you're at top speed, and you're braking with DRS on into turn 10. You probably need a different brake balance for that. And then maybe, we don't have a chicane anymore, but maybe you get to the chicane and you need something else. So that's the kind of loop that the driver, A, needs CPU in order to say, what's the car doing? Is there anything with the brakes that we can do? And then the performance engineer is looking through that data as well, saying, I noticed the rear brakes are locking into turn 10. Is it bothering you? And can we do anything about that? And then if they have the processor to be able to pick that up, and both Max and Checo were good at that. But Max was quite good. Both of them were quite good. It's like, right, I've got rear locking in turn 10. It's like, cool. But you have to give them a change. It's like, okay, it's this and this on the steering wheel. Can you do that? And then go back after that corner. Yeah, okay, cool. And they're doing that lap after lap after lap.
How much of your reactive work on the pit wall is down to the feedback from the drivers, and how much is down to, because you only take essentially a skeleton crew out to the race itself. You've got a huge amount of people back at base in mission control doing their thing and reviewing data. Have you got them in one ear going, hey, Blake, look out for this, watch that, something's happening, and you've got the drivers saying other things are feeding into you? What are all the data points that are coming into you during a race
for performance engineer and race engineer? That's pretty interesting. So we'll take the race engineer out. That guy's, he's looking after gaps on track, he's looking after strategy, looking after communications with the driver, and the performance engineer is feeding him, you know, any information coming from the factory. Any relevant stuff goes to the engineers, go to the driver. Performance engineer, you've got a couple things, and I've got a cool story about Miami last week, which makes it very clear what was happening because it was broadcast quite well. You're talking to aerodynamics performance engineers, looking at maybe there's an issue, you have a collision, how much aero balance have you lost? Let's say you get damage to the side of the floor. Have you lost aero balance? Okay, the engineer needs to know that because you need to make a front wing adjustment for the next stint, because you know how much you need to take off for the next tire. But what about, we've lost a percent of aero balance because we've got a hole in the side pod, kind of thing. So that's one thing. The next is maybe there's people at the back of the factory looking after brake health, and it's like, oh, we noticed that this is happening. And the performance engineers are like, a lot of systems health, a lot of performance stuff, but you're also getting feedback from the guys at the factory, like, hey, we've noticed your break wear is quite high. You might need to make some changes for that. Talk to the, then you'll take that information and talk to the race engineer. He'll package that up to deal with the driver. But a cool story from Miami was we saw a lot of people having issues in the high speed section, 5, 6, into 7. In qualifying, Leclerc had issues there. Max had issues there on his first run. And it was a very tricky corner during the race. And throughout the race, if you go back and listen to Max's onboard, there's a really interesting conversation between the driver and race engineer talking about brake balance and differential settings for cornering balance. And that's the kind of like reactive work you're doing. You're having a dialogue during a race. It's like, what's the problem? Help me pinpoint this. You take that information, you go look at the data, look at the wheel slips, look at the balance and say, okay, we've got a brake balance map and a diff map that can maybe help this. And they're trying stuff through the whole middle stint. And actually you saw that he found a lot of performance there as they stabilized the car on that super, super long, that was on the hard stint in the middle of it. And that was one of the things, like you look back at that as a performance engineer. And that's the kind of work that you do on a Sunday that helps make a difference. Because if they hadn't resolved that, there's a very good chance that Max might not have had as great of a charge through on that hard tire on that long run.
How do you, because you're coming from the engineer point of view, you look at the data, the numbers, the theoretical optimum versus a driver who's a fleshy human being who can make mistakes, who has good days and bad days. How close would you say, Blake, these drivers are, having worked with Checo, with Max Verstappen, how close are they to the theoretical optimum, do you think?
That's a really interesting question. And I think rather I'll turn that question on its head and ask it a different way, because a lot of the time there's engineers that are like, oh, this is the optimum solution. And it's like, that's not even remotely drivable. And you are dealing with a human who is prone to mistakes. They have tendencies and characteristics they like. And I think one of the things that you see that Red Bull has done really well with their approach to engineering the car and running the car is they've taken that very much into consideration, the human aspect. Like, use the numbers, use the simulations and tools to find here's where the performance is, and understand, like, if the simulation says this super peaky characteristic gives you a lot of performance, you go back and you test that and you work with the drivers through the simulators, like, all right, what about this? Let's say you've got 10% more peak, but it has really weird characteristics and has lots of drop off once you go outside this window. Or what are you faster over, a race or a qualifying lap, or this thing that has 10% less peak and it has very little drop off? Which one do you like? And working through that and making good compromises between the analytical technical optimum and what is usable performance. And I think that's something that they do really well.
There's one thing I wanted to ask both of you, actually. So to get a perspective from a performance engineer, someone, you know, very much who's been on the inside of Formula One, and from a fan's perspective with you, Tom. So, and I we spoke about this on, I did the race podcast recently, the F1 Focus one, and we talked about this with Alex Brundle and got his take on DRS. And, you know, DRS is quite a polarizing thing. Everyone understands why it's been brought in. But Blake, to you first, from an engineering perspective, are you a fan of DRS? Is it good for the spectacle, or should we bin it all together?
I will say right now, with these cars, it is a necessary evil. And let's take us aside, because you've got cars that are in a different league using DRS to pass a car. Let's say, for example, when you have a Red Bull coming through the pack after they've done a stop, that's not a useful comparison. Look at Miami as a specific. Look at the midfield. There were great wheel-to-wheel battles. And I'm taking one event. Like, we need to realistically look at the whole season. I think DRS is a necessary evil right now, considering how draggy the cars are and how much downforce you want to have on them. They're big. They're way too big from a spectacle point of view. I don't love it, but I think it's necessary. Otherwise, you know, you have the concept of the DRS train, and it's a bad, horrible thing. What do you call a pack of cars that are unable to overtake that don't have DRS? If you removed it, you'd call it a train of cars. You know, so it's like you tag this name onto this thing, but that's not actually the problem. The problem is overtaking is quite difficult unless you can generate a pace gap, which in the midfield, we say a pace gap is good because the cars are quite close. You know, you look at a fourth back to eighth place team on any given race weekend, those cars are pretty close in terms of performance. So, okay, you can't generate overtakes that way. You'll have moves on the brakes and stuff, and we saw a lot of those in Miami. The only way you generate overtakes is by generating a top speed delta. And yes, if the DRS overtake happens, you know, as soon as you go full throttle, that's boring. I'm not excited about that. You know, but if you have moves on the braking, that's exciting.
Yeah, I think necessary evil is the right way of putting it. Because, I mean, what makes Formula One Formula One is the fact it's open wheel, the fact that you've got these big wings. There is a certain aesthetic, I think, we associate with Formula One that's different to, say, NASCAR, where these, you know, saloons can go 200 plus mile an hour within millimeters of each other, lap after lap after lap, right? So I think if we want to preserve that aesthetic of these cars and have such reliant on this external aero, obviously, yes, ground effect is helping take away that focus on that external aero, but it's still a part of the racing. I think active aero going forward, you know, DRS is one form of active aero. I think if we want to continue to make these cars more efficient, which is clearly something that's important to F1, not just with the engines, but also, yeah, having, you know, aerodynamics that move during the race that potentially could then cause less dirty air. It's difficult as well, where I think we need to give these regulations more time to kick in. Exactly as you say, Blake, if you look at the midfield and how close that is, if you look right now, every single team in five races has made Q3 at least once. Every single team, all 10. So yes, Red Bull were taken away at the front, but actually when you look at the totality of it and don't just focus on the top, actually the sport is very competitive right now. I'd argue as competitive as it's ever been from top to tail anyway, because you've always had, you know, teams hanging off the back and that are nowhere near. We don't really have that now, which is good. I just think that, yeah, I don't think banning DRS is the solution, because of what, unless we're going to turn these cars into big Formula Fords with no front and rear wing. Maybe let's do that. But even then, you still get the wheel wake, don't you? Because, I mean, the tyres themselves kick up loads of dirty air, don't they, Blake?
Yeah. We could. There won't be Formula cars too soon if we do that.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's such a conundrum, isn't it, to get the balance right. But I mean, I don't mind it particularly, but I know a lot of people, it turns them off because they think it's manufactured fun. But, you know, it's also interesting to see how the teams develop it. I mean, like you say, Red Bull, whatever they've done to their DRS is just ridiculously better than anyone else on the grid. So, you know, you've got to just hold your hands up and go fair play. They've you know, maximize their knowledge to.
But also, I think even that, like, correct me if I'm wrong, Blake, but the benefit that Red Bull get from their DRS relative to the rest, I think the Haas is like the second most efficient from what I've seen. Like, I think there's other things that play into, you know, when Max took off past Lewis in Australia, well, I think Lewis's sector was like a second slower anyway than his previous. So I think, I'm reluctant to get carried away with, you know, because it is fine margins. We were talking when we spoke on Monday, Blake, like it's about 0.5%, which is a lot. In modern F1, that's a lot. But you go back into the glory days of the 90s and 80s and 70s, these cars were finishing like three laps behind. And it's always been like that with F1. That's the thing. Yeah. This isn't abnormal. Yeah. This is how it's always been.
Yeah, the glory days. The rose-tinted glasses, isn't it?
Yeah, I will say, looking back statistically, I did an analysis looking at 2021 versus 2022. And my buddy Jasper and I did a deep dive on all the races throughout the season. And it was something like the average gap reduced by, I think it was a very substantial margin across the board. You know, every single race, like for like, spread was closer. The time that the cars spent in 1 second of each other had increased substantially. The regulations are going in the right direction. We had a hint that in Baku that cars couldn't follow as well. Then you go to Miami and it's like you have a gaggle of cars like this stacked on top of each other. So I think it's worth making sure that we look at seasons as a whole, clusters of races. Some races have very, very weird things. But I think the quality of racing is improving. And I think the thing people are talking about, overtakes are not really important as a metric, you know, because we look at and even the ability to follow closely, like Silverstone last year was a great race, but it had huge field spread, like one of the highest of the season. And like, okay, that's not the metric on the last thing I'll say on is the thing that we need is we need battles. Not a single lap overtake. You need a battle. You need cars, tooth and nail, wheel to wheel for two or three laps in a row. Give me a couple of those and I'll be happy every day. Give me a dive on the brakes. I'm a little bit excited. Give me an overtake on DRS early in the straight. I'm kind of bored, but give me a battle that lasts two laps between any drivers. Sign me up. Inject more of that.
I agree with you. And you want to see an overtake that's earned. You know, you look at Formula E in Berlin the other week, there were over 300 overtakes in two races, you know, that, and which is great on one hand. A lot of, you know, I think that's fantastic entertainment, but is it too easy? You know, just swapping places left, right and center. Is that really what we want? I think we'd argue probably not in Formula One.
But it makes it difficult also to follow the narratives because you have, you know, if you have 10 narratives unfolding simultaneously, you can't give any of them the due attention and you can't give all of them any attention.
Yeah. Absolutely.
This is what I think people think, you know, we want all 20 cars to be able to fight for race wins. I don't think so. I think part of what made 2021 was so compelling is because you had two drivers from two different teams head to head and you have that breakup, and that's typically how it works in sports. You have the big names who typically rise to the top, but you also have the underdog stories, and you wouldn't get those underdog stories if everyone could win. So
yeah, but it's a technology race as well, isn't it? And you want the big brains, you know, to rise to the top, not just the drivers. It's a tech race. Anyway, we could go on this for hours. we've kept you long enough, Blake. So we'll come on to our final three, which are brought to us by our sponsors at WTF1Talent.com. Head to WTF1Talent if you're a budding F1 content creator and interested to hear how you can supercharge your career. So, Tom, do you want to kick off with number one?
Of course. So, Blake, what has got you excited at the moment?
Is it okay if it's not Formula One?
Yes, yep. Of course.
I am really excited to go to my first endurance race since the Petit Le Mans in 2007. I'm going to the 100th anniversary of the 24 Hours of Le Mans soon.
Awesome.
I'm so excited.
That'd be amazing.
You know, and I've been so isolated in the world of Formula One as a professional now, as a content creator on the outside for 12 years, and now it's like I'm opening my eyes. I knew it's out there. I just didn't have time or mental capacity to think about everything else, but now I'm gonna go see it. I'm gonna go see some of my friends driving, and it's gonna be a blast. I'm so thrilled for that. I'm honestly like goosebumps thinking about it.
I think the 24 Hour Le Mans is one of those. Wait, just a follow-up question to that, just briefly. What is there a place still for the rest of the World Endurance Championship when you look at like the 6 hours races? You know, is it with the attention spans of people these days, do people really want to watch a 6 hour race?
I don't know. I know there's the super enthusiasts that do want to watch it. Here's what the only thing I will say is I maybe I didn't look hard enough, but the highlights, 5 minutes of highlights from the 6 hours of Spa is not enough. There's no narratives. It's like, here's a crash, here's who won. So I feel like that needs a little bit of love, because if you could boil that 6 hour down and then drip feed it to somebody and give them the narratives and the strategy and how it works, I think you'd get a lot more people excited about it, because I think that's super lacking. We had Drive to Survive do the Formula One thing where you focus on the drama, and then you pulled all these people in. You have so many people consuming. I mean, Tomo, you speak to this, the growth of your YouTube channel, which is congratulations. I can't wait to see it. I'm going to unsubscribe and resubscribe just to give you a little bit of momentum. But, you know, you've seen that. And cheers, that's bro. And that's down to the perfect storm of Drive to Survive, all the content, all the content creators as well, including it in that. And then that, but it's like, where's that for WEC? You know, where is that?
It's not good enough to just cut it up. Like, you need to.
It's got the chemistry. It's got the drama.
You need to do extra highlights. Yeah. You need to do supercharged highlights where there is actually maybe something on screen that tells you, like, oh, and this is, yeah. You're right. It definitely needs repackaging, I think.
I think it could use. I think there's some low hanging fruit there potentially. But yeah, I'm excited about that.
Second question for you. How much of your success do you put down to luck and right place, right time? And how much do you put down to sheer hard work and grafting?
I'll take being lucky any day. But at the same time,
you've got to be in the right place for it.
Exactly. And I feel like that notion is, you completely nailed that one there. You have to put in the work in order to put yourself in a good position. If you fluke it, you can fluke it once and you probably won't be able to sustain anything off of that. It's the same thing of having like a, let's say, a piece of short form content pop off. It gets millions of views. What are you going to do with that? Nothing.
Yep. Yeah.
If you can't do it again, if you don't have anything to package around that, it can have a huge growth on other platforms. And then all the other platforms go dead because it was just luck. So I think in my context of, you know, getting into Formula One, there was a lot of hard work. I didn't have a life for a very long time. And it's a very single-minded approach to a lot of these things. And I worked pretty hard. I made the right connections. I met the right people, but I was also the right person that was there. The same thing goes for getting the job as trackside engineer when they needed somebody. I had put in the work. I'd had the enthusiasm. I had not screwed up too much or at all. And they're like, right, can you be that person that fills the spot now? And then sink or swim, I didn't sink. I swam pretty well and then ended up getting a job at Red Bull after that, which I don't think a lot of people know, is that was to be Sebastian Vettel's performance engineer, just coming off of all those world championships. And he was like, I was like, okay, at that point I was like, okay, maybe I'm not a fraud. I don't know.
And then he left. He was like, oh, Blake's coming. Yeah, I can't, I'm gonna have to go to Ferrari.
Yeah, yeah. That guy's shit.
Yeah. No, so I think you make your own luck, but you've got to put in the work and you've got to position yourself for everything.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. All right. Final question, Blake. Apart from this bright fluorescent Mercedes t-shirt, which obviously is a Red Bull boy, must terrify you somewhat. What are you scared of, Blake?
How much time you got?
As long as you need.
No.
One thing.
Lie down on the couch.
No, what am I scared of? I don't know. That's a really, really tough question. Here's one thing I don't like. I do not like speaking up on something that I don't know about. And the idea of being put on the spot to answer something that I don't know about and saying the wrong thing, I will always, like, I have this problem a lot. It's like people will lean very heavily into stuff that they're completely uneducated on and be very abrasive, especially on the toilet, which is F1 Twitter. And it's a lot of the time. Yeah, funny that. But it's like, I don't want to speak up on topics that I'm not well informed of, because I pride myself on trying to be authentic and genuine. I'm not there to get a quick win for clout. I'm like, if I don't know anything about this, I'm going to tag somebody else that does, or I'm going to go away and do some research. So that's saying something and not saying the right thing. That's terrifying.
I'm going to add a fourth, very, very quick one. You've dived into this content creator world. You've got great traction. Things are looking good. But will you ever go back to Formula One?
I don't think so. And I'll tell you why. I feel like Formula One is getting big, is getting really, really big. And it's not this super agile dynamic. I mean, it is still super agile and dynamic, but it's like everybody is super, super specialized. You have, you know, you don't have people like Adrian Newey now. Don't have the ability to change the direction of the entire organization now like they could before. There's too many moving parts. There's too much technically going on. How many aerodynamicists do you actually have in a Formula One team now? And then you expand that concept to everything else in it. I'm not that interested in it anymore, because you're super, super specialized in everything you do. And I have done enough of that specialization. I don't think I'm the best at anything I've ever done. But I'm still curious. And if I'm paid to do one very specific thing, that takes all the time off of my plate to learn about all these other things. You know, the idea of learning about IndyCar, the technology, WEC, Formula E, spending more time consuming this stuff and talking about it with people like you is what gets me excited. Going and optimizing the aerodynamic drag correlation model for the wind tunnel for a month at a time is fun. But I don't want to do that for 3 more months. And I don't want to, tuning in the tire model, very specific studies. I want to do bigger picture stuff. I want to look at it. And even if I was a senior technical person. There's too many politics and anything else involved. I'm having too much fun right now.
Yeah. That's so often. It's like going in from a small business where you need lots of people, when you need fewer people that can do lots of different things versus a bigger business where you become, everyone's a smaller cog in the machine. So everyone's specialized. And I guess, yeah, it's been that gradual, maybe, you know, WEC, IndyCar, one day we'll see Blake on the pit wall. Boom.
There might be something else in the near future, but I can't talk about it.
What a tease.
I'll message you after this to tell
me. Yeah. We'll see.
Well, listen, Blake, it's been fascinating having you on. My brain is slightly melting now as I sort of try and unpack some of the performance engineering bits and pieces. But it's been a pleasure having you on. Thank you so much for taking the time. And I'm sure we'll chat to you again. But for now, Blake, thanks for joining us on the Motormouth podcast.
Thank you so much, Tim, Tomo. I'll see you guys soon. I'm sure of it.
Thank you so much for listening to the Motormouth podcast. Do make sure you give us a follow on our socials, Twitter at Motormouth _, Instagram at Motormouth _official, and Facebook, just search Motormouth. You can also download the Motormouth app where you can get exclusive video content from MMTV, create your own social profile to interact with other fans, and check up on all the latest happenings with whatever motorsport takes your fancy. We're also proud to be supporting the Brain Tumor Charity too, so make sure you check the links in the podcast description to find out how you can help cure brain tumors quicker. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and review. And until next time, you've been listening to the Motormouth podcast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.